I can say for myself that I undertook the march abroad on royal authorization, with a firm trust that my service would be as evident and distinguished as my ancestors, and that I would not need to speak to be counted among those Your Majesty honors for diligence and fidelity in affairs of state. But my counsel and constancy availed nothing toward those objectives we set out to gain in your interests for our sins. In fact, no other of the many armed expeditions into those parts has found itself in such dire straits as ours, or come to so futile and fatal a conclusion. Although the North American expedition, of which Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca was second in command, was a disaster for colonizing, it was a treasure trove of knowledge about the people and landscape of a large part of the continent, as it was in the 1530s. Why did the expedition go so terribly awry? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What were Florida, Texas, and the American Southwest like nearly 500 years ago, as seen through the eyes of the Spanish? And what kind of men were those Spanish explorers who came to see it? And how did his several years' sojourn among the Indians change Cabeza de Vaca? Our guest, Brenda Becerra Anderson, has read Cabeza de Vaca's report to the King of Spain in the original 16th century Spanish. She's a doctoral student in the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at the UW-Madison.
Well, welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
We think of Christopher Columbus, you know, there are other explorers that are household names. Cabeza de Vaca is not one of those figures for most of us if we're not in that particular area of study. But boy, what a fascinating life and adventures. Tell us what the most important thing you think is that we know about Cabeza de Vaca.
Well, Cabeza de Vaca's text is really important because it's a text of a failed expedition, so it really is something new during that time period. We're used to seeing these expeditions succeed, and they bring back riches. Cabeza de Vaca comes back to the king with nothing. Well, not nothing. He shows through this text, really, that he has something more valuable than the riches and the gold that they can get from the Americas, and that's the knowledge. And that's what Norman had said of the information of the landscape and the natives. And just his text is a bit of a novel, and that also gives it value, and it's something different. Other texts of that time period are very chronological. Day one, day two, day three, this is what we saw. They just record observations. And his does a little more than that.
It actually records his own change in thinking over the course of those years of extreme suffering, privation, and I guess you could say enlightenment.
Definitely.
Now, where did he come from? This name, first of all, we have to talk about Cabeza de Vaca, head of a cow. It doesn't sound like something you would necessarily brag about, but that's the way he's known.
Right. It was a title given on his mother's side. If I remember correctly, the story goes that this shepherd helped out the king's army against a battle with probably the Moors and Muslims in Spain, and he led them through this corral where there was cows. And so the king decided to title him for helping them win that battle and give him the name Cabeza de Vaca.
Well, tell us about the expedition that he was part of. Who else was on it? How many hundreds of people? What their goal was when they sailed off from Spain?
Well, their goal was to conquer that territory and definitely start building colonies there.
And what did they think was already there? What did they already know before they set out?
Well, they knew that America was a vast land. Lots of explorers kept going. They didn't know a lot. They were definitely the first ones to reach that area. So it was just an expedition of conquering more new land.
And they were pretty well established by, this is about, let's see, almost 50 years, 40, 50 years past the time of Columbus's first discovery of America. So the Spanish were pretty well established in the Caribbean and Cuba and parts of South America, but had really hadn't gone that much into North America.
Correct. Cortez had been in Mexico, into Mexico City, into the Aztec Empire. But yes, Florida and that southwest area hadn't been explored. So they always assumed that they were going to find riches. Like any trip, any expedition to America, they would find either gold or other types of natural resources. And
to what extent was it a missionary expedition?
They would bring missionaries with to help. It was a way to for the crown to. It was more of a discourse, I guess. They did converge to a point, but it was definitely to defend and justify the expeditions and the conquest, because it was conquest by any means. So to defend and justify, especially against, at that time, the competition, the Dutch, the French, the English, the Portuguese, they said it was primarily to convert and save these lives that they have just discovered.
The ones that still existed, the ones that survived.
Right. Correct. It was to save lives, to save souls.
If not lives.
Well, let's turn to a discussion of his narrative, because that's going to tell us a story of what happens. And tell us about the title of the book, or the text that he came up with, and his dedication of it to the King of Spain.
So his title was changed to Naufragios, which translates to shipwrecked. And that, I think, gives more emphasis on what happened to him, brings in the reader. And he dedicates this text to the king. He wasn't obligated at all to transcribe what happened. That wasn't part of his occupation. But he knows, in order to be in favor, and he also had ambition. He tries to hide it in his text, but we know that when he comes back, he's asking to go on the following expedition. But for that one, he wants to be in charge of it.
Well, you can kind of understand that, can't you, given what happens on this expedition?
Right. He did suffer a lot. He spent a lot of time in the Americas. But it's his way to show his service to the king. But there's an agenda. He wants to be in favor. He wants to then be the leader of a following expedition to the Americas. And what he shows is he gives value to his suffering and to misfortune. He's showing that it went wrong, completely wrong. It was a failed expedition, but he is able to give this valuable information as someone who has lived with the natives. Other texts, they're observations from afar. We get these narratives of conquistadores, and they're just observing from afar what they think, how they interpret. And he can give information as an insider.
So where does it start to go wrong? They're coming, obviously, from Spain and then to Cuba. And I guess they're gathering some resources in that general vicinity. But then they go to Florida. And tell us about the number one in command and how he and Cabeza de Vaca got along or didn't.
And also how many people were with them.
Yes, I think it was about 600. And there was three ships?
Several ships.
Or
yeah,
five.
I think it was five altogether.
And it starts to go wrong in once they reach Florida. And Pánfilo Narváez, he's in charge of this expedition. And we see throughout their troubles and misfortunes, him and Cabeza de Vaca are not getting along. Cabeza de Vaca shows himself as a bit more rational and level-headed in his decision-makings, and he's giving his commander good recommendations. We should wait. We should wait for the other ships. Let's not split up. Let's just be patient. Let's wait until we can find a better port to go into. And Pánfilo, he's represented as more irrational and self-interested. He doesn't want to wait. He's very impatient. He wants to go ahead and just go. And he's sure of himself that they're going to find the port will be fine and the ships will be fine. And
do we know that? I mean, is there any sort of confirmation of that? Or are we just reading a text from the survivor who can say anything he wants to about his former leader?
We're reading a text from the survivor who can say anything.
Survivors write the history, don't they?
That's right. according to the survivor, mm-hmm. he was under the command of someone who was rash and ambitious and
yes.
foolhardy.
Mm-hmm. And that's the way he paints it, definitely.
Mm-hmm. But in fact, I mean, somebody made the decision as they went to Florida to separate the ships mm-hmm. from the men. And it wouldn't have been Cabeza de Vaca's place to make that decision. So it had to be mm-hmm. Narvaez.
Right.
As first in command.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happens then? They reach Florida and...
They reach Florida and they go through a series of storms. They come along and continue to hit them. And the ships wreck and the natives attack and they lose a lot of people. They lose horses. They lose their resource that they have in their ships. And then they're left really to fend for themselves.
I wonder if there's a passage. I know, Norman, you're reading it for Chapter a Day starting next week.
It'll be on February 10th,
right.
A week from tomorrow.
But is there a passage from the text that describes that sort of horrific encounter with disaster there?
Yes, I'll hold it right there. This is one of the encounters that they experienced when they were working their way up the coast of Florida. On July 19th or 20th, we negotiated lakes and trails without seeing a single native. But on the second day, while chest deep in the middle of a lake which hidden logs helped make difficult to cross, a band of Indians concealed behind groves and fallen timber wounded quite a few men and horses and captured our guide before we could get through the water. They pressed after us, intending to dispute the narrow passage, but when we turned on them, they fled to the safety of the lake whence their arrows continued to hit men and beasts. The governor commanded our cavalry to dismount and charge the Indians afoot. The comptroller dismounted and charged with them. The Indians retreated into the lake and we gained the passage. Good armor did no good against arrows in this skirmish. There were men who swore they had seen two red oaks, each the thickness of a man's calf, pierced from side to side by arrows this day, which is no wonder when you consider the power and skill the Indians can deliver them with. I myself saw an arrow buried half a foot in a poplar trunk.
Must have been terrifying for these men from Spain who were suddenly wandering in the land along the coast.
Right. And without their resources, and they usually have the advantage of having horses and this armor, but in a shipwreck, when you lose all that, you're left with nothing. And now the Indians, really the natives, have the advantage.
And what do the men think they were doing? Like, they're out there and they're trying to do what?
That was, it's that lack of communication that we see in these texts. It just predominates. They don't really know what they're saying, and they can't communicate. Eventually, they will have translators, they'll have interpreters that will help them, natives. But before that, it's really the Spaniards just trying to interpret, you know, their body gestures, they're just their activities, their movements. When they see their customs, they're just trying to interpret what they think is what's going on. And the same thing with the natives. They see these new people. They don't know what they want either.
The Spaniards at this point, though, as they're slogging their way up the coast of Florida and they're fording rivers and losing men and horses to drowning and to Indian attacks and of course, to hunger and pretty soon to disease and just about anything that could go wrong will go wrong. Their goal at this point is it to just kind of continue to see what's there, or are they heading toward the sort of legendary, more prosperous part of North America, the so-called Appalachian?
Right. I'm not sure. I'm not sure where they were going. I think they...
They're obviously working their way up the west coast of Florida, which they think is this vast area. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the way they're doing it, it is. I mean, it's because they're going slowly up the Gulf Coast is what they're doing.
I don't have an answer for that one. They're going up north, but
I suppose eventually what they're really doing is just looking for something to eat.
Right. They're definitely in survival mode, and trying to see how they can get in and out of this territory. Usually they would come in and they would from the coast, and there would be a big port, and it would be easy to maneuver in and out, but they can't find that.
It's, you know, when you mentioned the problem of communication, not knowing what the natives were thinking and wanting, but also I was thinking just the problem of communication among the men themselves. We're so used to, you know, the cell phone kind of instant connection with people, and to have this group of hundreds of Spaniards who have arrived in a place where they don't even really have a map or don't know where they're going. And if they are separating from each other, they can't know what's happening to some other group. Now,
right.
How did they even anticipate that it would go other than sort of fizzling out? Because they can't keep it together if they don't stay together.
Right. And at the beginning of the text, they also lose some men. I think it was in Cuba.
To the storms. They had what must have been a hurricane by the description of it.
So along their way, they're losing men. They're sending out smaller armies to go explore. And you're right. They can't connect. They can't call each other on the cell phone or text. they really have to trust each other. But also, not everyone's going to follow the rules. There's a lot of examples of expeditions going wrong, or one boat deciding, hey, we're going to go explore somewhere else. I know the commander is telling us to go here, but we're going to do our own exploration. And that happened quite a bit. Some would decide, they're very ambitious, that they were going to just at the spur of the moment, they were going to create their own different expedition and not follow. So you would lose a lot of men.
Yeah, actually, early on, before they've even left for Florida, Cabeza de Vaca mentions that 140 men were just induced by the locals to just jump ship. And so they right away, there was 140 guys just, well, we'd rather go do something else.
Right.
And then they have this hurricane, and I think that drowns another like 60 men and 20 horses. Mm-hmm. And I guess in retrospect, you can kind of see, it's easy to say, well, those guys were crazy to want to leave the ships and go inland. But then when you realize that staying on the ships had killed all those men back in the Caribbean, and how terrifying a storm on a ship can be.
Right.
You can kind of understand they'd willingly take their chances on land, but it just turned out to be a lot worse.
It almost sounds like Odysseus, where there's just one adventure and obstacle after the next. I did notice with Cabeza de Vaca that he, in his text, keeps sounding as if it was just all part of God's plan. You know, God provided, or God did this. And so maybe there's a sort of fatalistic sense that whatever happens, happens. Just surrender to it.
Yes, there's a strong religious discourse in his text. Throughout, he gives thanks to God for the few fortunes, the finding corn, finding maíz, finding Indians that will help them. He'll contribute all that to God, and but also he's also showing himself as a self-sacrificing martyr. He
well, is, that's a Christian concept.
Mm-hmm, and he is suffering, but kind of for the good of the cause, and he does work as a healer, and he again. The way that he explains that he's able to heal the sick is through prayer.
And we'll get into this whole concept of these Spanish explorers becoming medicine men among the Indians when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Brenda Becerra Anderson. And she's telling us about this phenomenal account written in 1542 by Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. It's a report to King Charles V of Spain regarding this disastrous expedition to Florida. In a general sense, they would call it Florida. And this expedition was one in which Cabeza de Vaca was second in command, had issues with the commander, differences of opinion that led to the splitting of the men from the ships and catastrophe as the men worked their way up the Gulf Coast of Florida. Indian attacks, starvation, drowning, just about anything that could go wrong did. So in this sort of pit of despair, Brenda, what options do the Spaniards have if they're going to survive this trip up the Gulf Coast?
Not many. and they don't have the builders that they need, the men. So they build these barges and go up the Mississippi, and that leads them up north into Texas. But as his story, it never goes as planned. It's never a perfect ending. So they get split up. Cabeza de Vaca is able to tell us what happens on his. And along the way, he encounters more of the Spaniards that had been separated. And then they're able to fill him in. And he's able to tell us, by their words, their account, what happened to the others.
So they get to Texas. And what part of Texas is this?
Northern Texas.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so still a good ways from Mexico, although they really, I gather, have no idea how far it is.
Right, there's still a good ways from Mexico.
And they seem to be kind of making up names to things as they go, because they're not following a guidebook or a map. They're seeing rivers and lakes and areas where they're sort of calling it something, right?
Right. This was a common rhetoric for authority for the conquistadores. It was a way to claim that it was theirs. So we see this with Cristobal Colón. He'll start claiming that this is the island of so-and-so or the land of so-and-so. And by giving it a new name, they're renaming it and claiming it theirs and taking it away from the natives. So it was common for these Spaniards to just start naming landscapes and rivers and lakes that they encountered. Because in their eyes, it was their land as they're going through. They were documenting it, and eventually, it would be their land. And
I gather, however, you've got this one barge of half-starved Spaniards. They're not exactly in a position to claim this part of Texas that they land on. Their hand is a little weak, you might say. What do they encounter in terms of the native reception in Texas?
The reception in Texas was friendlier. The natives did help them out by bringing them food, providing shelter, and blankets.
And it seems as if one of the things that Cabeza de Vaca learns early on is that one tribe is not necessarily like another, and that you can't make generalizations about all the Indians. They meet such a variety of people along the way. I've seen him referred to as a proto-anthropologist, that he's one of the first ones to kind of document the different cultures, different traditions. I wonder if we could hear a sample of his writing about the early encounter with what we call Texas.
Well, this is one that will give you a little bit of idea of the specifics, not just of the various or this particular tribe's kind of daily life, but also the unpredictability of the reception. We followed these Indians to their houses at the water's edge, close by, and stepped ashore. In front of the dwelling stood many clay jars of water and a great quantity of cooked fish, all of which the chief of this land offered our governor before leading us to his palace. Their dwellings were made of mats and, so far as we could tell, were not movable. When we officers entered the chief's palace, he regaled us with fish. We gave him some of the corn we had brought, which his people ate in our presence, and asked for more. We gave them more. The governor also presented the chief some trinkets. In the middle of the night, the Indians fell on us without warning. Not only the governor's party in the chief's lodge, but also our sick men strewn on the beach. The governor got hit in the face with a rock. Some of us grabbed the chief, but a group of Indians retrieved him, leaving us holding his robe of civet marten skins. And then he can't help doing a little fashion riff here. In the middle of this battle, he says, "These are the finest skins in the world, I believe. Their fragrance seems like amber and musk and can be smelled a long way off. We saw other tribes here, but none to match this one." And then he gets us back to the battle. Those of us in the vicinity where the governor got hurt managed to put him in his barge and to hasten all but 50 of our force aboard theirs. The 50 stood guard high up on the beach. Three times that night the Indians attacked with such ferocity as to force us back more than a stone's throw each time.
And what does he mean by the governor here? That's been referred to all along.
That's Panfilo.
That's right. His commander. Mm-hmm.
That's his commander, yes.
But they call him the governor.
The governor. That was the title for the commander of the expedition. Because that would be, once they landed, he would then be a governor, right? Mm-hmm. And have jurisdiction over everybody. Mm-hmm.
And when Norman's reading that, and I know he's doing the whole thing for a chapter a day, it sounds as if the writer, Cabeza de Vaca, will be recounting these horrific things without a whole lot of emotion or excitement. How does it read in the original Spanish?
In the original Spanish, it's very dramatic. He describes everything with an extreme. He's over the top. It's the best and the worst and the strongest and the nicest with his encounters with the natives and with Mother Nature as well. He also describes, he definitely described Florida as this inhospitable, destructive, hostile land. Because they were encountering so many storms. And there's a funny episode where he says that eight men needed to hold on to each other and hug each other so they wouldn't be blown away. That was the intensity. So in Spanish, the original text, very dramatic in most of his scenes.
I wonder if we could get a sample of that you might read.
Yes.
Tell us what we're going to be, for those of us who don't know Spanish, especially 16th century Spanish, tell us what it will be about.
I have this excerpt here, and this is taking us a little farther along in his narrative, where he starts to do healing. And him and his men become these medicine men. And in this one particular case, he resuscitates the dead. So this is the biggest accomplishment that he's able to do, and brings him this recognition with the natives. And this is when he starts to have a following, and we see his status change from many years a slave to now this healer that natives come from different areas to get blessed and to get cured.
Maybe we better back it up a bit before you read it. Tell us about this many years a slave. Tell us about. We kind of skipped over that. So let's talk about that part.
He sort of skips over that too, doesn't he? He mentions it, mm-hmm. but he doesn't go into a lot of detail.
He doesn't. We know that he's jumping from tribe to tribe. He recounts many different ones. There's a long list that he encounters, and he describes the treatment Sometimes it's good treatment. Sometimes it's bad.
But he's taken as a prisoner.
Yes.
And what led to that originally? I mean, and is that it for – is he separated from the governor, from his commander-in-chief at that point?
Eventually he is, and he encounters other Spaniards with other tribes, and they're really put to work. They don't because they're separated and they're naked and hungry. The natives put them to work as well as they help them by feeding them. And he has stories of being beaten and others seeing mistreatment of the slaves and saying that it was the worst treatment ever seen in, you know, in humanity of a slave, that because that's how he's over the top. So he'll give that example. And it's until he becomes this healer that his status changes. And now they're giving him things, and he's getting these offerings through this work as a healer. But before that, it was – he doesn't give, as Norman said, a lot of detail of what he was doing as a slave. Mm-hmm. We just know he says that they were enslaved.
And before we get into the actual Spanish – it's probably worth pointing out that the Indians weren't exactly having a picnic either. I mean, life was pretty rough mm-hmm. for those tribes in Texas in particular, the mm-hmm. coast of Texas.
Right.
They would go for months eating nothing but prickly pears, and that was the good times.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so we now have a dead body that he's going to approach. Mm-hmm. And he's allowed to come forward and try to help?
So the natives come from other areas asking for the healing, and they approach them. They say, we have someone, and no one wants to do it. Cabeza de Vaca, he is brave enough to try. His other men say no, they've been doing healing, but no one wants to try because they notice that he's dead, that the victim is dead. So he approaches and he tries his best, and we'll see how it ends.
Okay.
Cabeza de Vaca says, yo vi el enfermo que íbamos a curar que estaba muerto, porque estaba mucha gente alrededor de él llorando y su casa deshecha, que es señal que el dueño estaba muerto. Así, cuando yo llegué, hallé el indio los ojos vueltos y sin ningún pulso, y con todas las señales de muerto. Según a mí, me pareció, y lo mismo dijo Dorantes, yo le quité una estera que tenía encima, con que estaba cubierto, y lo mejor que pude apliqué a nuestro señor, fuese servido de dar salud a aquel y a todos los otros que de ella tenían necesidad. Después de santiguado y soplado muchas veces, me trajeron un arco y me lo dieron, y una cera de tunas molidas, y lleváronme a curar a otros muchos que estaban malos de modorra. Y me dieron otras dos ceras de tunas, las cuales di a nuestros indios, que con nosotros habían venido. Hecho esto, nos volvimos a nuestro aposento, y nuestros indios, a quien di las tunas, se quedaron allá. A la noche se volvieron a sus casas, y dijeron que aquel que estaba muerto y yo había curado en presencia de ellos, se había levantado, bueno, y se había paseado, y comido, y hablado con ellos, y que todos cuantos había curado quedaban sanos y muy alegres.
How does the 16th century Spanish compare to contemporary Spanish? You know, in English, of course, 16th century, we would compare Shakespeare with contemporary English. But does the Spanish have a sort of a courtly sound to it in the 16th century version?
It does. We can definitely compare it to the English version, the 16th century versus modern. It has changed a lot. It is difficult. There is vocabulary that I am unfamiliar with and I have to look up, and sometimes I have luck finding it in a dictionary, other times I can't, and other problems with the text. These travel writings is another problem, is that they're encountering things that they don't know, so sometimes they give them names, or they'll give us the just like the written name of the indigenous name. So there's a lot of vocabulary sometimes we just don't know, and we need linguists to help us out on that one.
Well, it sounded beautiful in Spanish, but I'd like to know exactly what was being said about the dead body.
So Cabeza de Vaca, he notes that the native is dead, and in his text he also inserts that others can confirm he was dead. He wants to show he was dead. The native was dead. He did. He prayed and blessed him as what his technique is, and I mean was. And then they gave him, and that was it. And then they gave him their offerings, which were more of the prickly pears and some arrows. And they left. They went back to their where they were staying. And the next day, the natives came back saying, "He's alive. You cured him. He was walking. He ate. He talked to us."
But no CPR.
No CPR.
No mouth to mouth.
Mouth to mouth. It was the blessing.
This is the way he describes actually the two contrasting techniques, medical techniques, the natives and his own. He says an Indian falling sick would send for a medicine man who would apply his cure. The patient would then give the medicine man. This sounds. Somebody will say this will sound a lot like today. The patient would then give the medicine man all he had and seek more for his relatives to give. Does that sound familiar? The medicine man makes incisions over the point of the pain, sucks the wound, and cauterizes it. This remedy enjoys high repute among the Indians. I have, as a matter of fact, tried it on myself with good results. The medicine men blow on the spot they have treated as a finishing touch, and the patient regards himself relieved. Our method, however, was to bless the sick, breathe upon them, recite a Pater Noster and Ave Maria, and pray earnestly to God, our Lord, for their recovery. You can believe that was a very earnest prayer, too, given the spot they were in. When we concluded with the sign of the cross, he willed, that is, God willed, that our patients should directly spread the news that they had been restored to health. As a consequence, the Indians treated us kindly. They deprived themselves of food to give to us and presented us skins and other tokens of gratitude. That sounds to us more like faith healing, but at least on one other occasion, he actually did surgery on this Indian that had an arrowhead buried deep in his chest. And Cabeza de Vaca actually opens his chest and digs out this huge arrowhead.
And then sews him back up.
Yeah, so he says like a couple of stitches, mm-hmm. and the guy was fine.
And do we need to at all have some skepticism that, again, we're reading an account by someone who's presenting himself in a heroic light despite a failed expedition because he wants the king to think favorably of him and send him out on something else? But do we need to perhaps question the veracity of any of these accounts or suspect they might be tall tales just a bit?
Yes. it is important to keep in mind his agenda and what he wants to gain from his writings. Cabeza de Vaca, he really just focuses on himself. He is the protagonist and the narrator. The reader is not able to connect with any other character and any other person in his expedition. Really, the commander, the governor, is the one he gives more information to because he finds himself disagreeing with him. But the others, it's a mention of a name, maybe a few descriptions, but it's really focused on what he's doing and what he has accomplished and his suffering. He'll mention the others, but we can't connect with them. There's not enough information.
And he's probably not going to talk about the time that he prayed over a dead body and nothing happened.
Right. We only
that would make for the exciting narrative.
He had
narrative.
Enough misfortunes already that he wants to focus on his success as a healer.
He definitely mentions that to a man. To a woman, these Indians represent themselves as cured, and they go away, as mm-hmm. he says, glad.
Mm-hmm. He does talk toward the end of his narrative about sort of the bad Christians and the sort of
right.
things like that. And we're going to look at those passages and the end of the journey of Cabeza de Vaca when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
Thank you.
At all this, the Christians were greatly vexed and told their own interpreter to say to the Indians how we were of their own race, but had gone astray for a long while and were people of no luck and little heart, whereas they were the lords of the land whom they should obey and serve. That's a sentence from the narrative by Cabeza de Vaca in 1542. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland and our guest Brenda Becerra Anderson. We are talking about the Spanish explorer Cabeza de Vaca and the failed expedition to the New World that he wrote an account about. We've taken him and the men that he traveled with first to Florida, then to Texas. He's become sort of a faith healer type, even though he's been serving as a slave to the native people. Can you talk about the ending of this narrative and also the way he portrays good and bad Christians?
Mm-hmm. So Cabeza de Vaca, and it's another thing that's unique about his narrative, is he shows how we need to approach the natives not so harshly, enslaving them, bringing war. He goes about it differently. He's able to convert them. He's able to order them to start building churches. At the end of his trip, they start to build churches. They listen to him to populate and work the land. So he's representing them as these good workers that they can be. Because before that, the land was not populated, and they didn't want to be there. They were scared because they had seen these bad Christians, these bad Spaniards come along that started to mistreat and abuse them. And usually we see in this time period, it's usually the missionaries that are writing in defense of the natives, of how we can't go about using war and these harsh tactics to convert them to Christianity. And it's the conquistadores that have a different mindset and a different tactic to go about it. So he kind of sides more with the missionaries at this point. Again, his story is different. He was shipwrecked and a slave, and he doesn't have the army to impose war, so he does it peacefully and is successful, according to his account.
Do you think because he was a slave, it taught him what it would be like to be treated that way? I mean, is that part of where his difference comes from?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I'm sure it influenced him a lot. He, as Norman said, that the natives and the Spaniards were experiencing horrible times of hunger. And I think that probably made a big impression on him and made him be able to relate to them, and also to be able to see Spaniards through the eyes of the natives, that these strangers come in and all of a sudden they start imposing this abuse on us. And he sees how it can be unfair. So he makes sure that he shows that there's differences. His men are nice. They're giving a lot during the time that they're healers. They're giving food, they're giving shelter, they're giving clothes, but he also gives it back to them. He takes what he needs, him and his men need, and they always give it back to the natives. And that's in contrast to the other Spaniards that he meets that are just taking and taking more and more and want and leave the natives with nothing.
So eventually they're down out of 300, I think, that actually hit the ground in Florida. They're down to four Spaniards, mm-hmm. Cabeza de Vaca and three others traveling with him. And they, I gather, because of the difficulties, let's say, of mm-hmm. Dealing with the coastal Indians in Texas, they kind of give up on this idea of getting back to Mexico and just decide to sort of work their way gradually west. He actually becomes, in addition to being a faith healer, he becomes a merchant and works his way west and does pretty well just trading from one tribe mm-hmm. to the next, I guess because these tribes, a lot of them were at war, but they had stuff that each other wanted. And he was a very handy way for them to trade without having to necessarily attack each other. And he ends up going through West Texas and into New Mexico. Barefoot, by the way, just one minor point there.
Right.
But he does encounter some really interesting customs. There's this one that the Indians traveling with him, when they come to a next tribe, it seems to be accepted behavior that you rip off everything that tribe has. When you come into their village, you literally take everything you can lay your hands on. Some of the stuff, when they see you coming, they'll hide it. But then when they go to the next village, they do the same thing.
Different concept of pay it forward, take it forward.
Yeah,
or
take it forward, yeah. And this is one custom that he finds very strange. There's nothing he can do about it,
right.
But everybody seems to just kind of live with it.
He accepts it, you're right. He doesn't agree with it, and he finds it strange, and he feels bad for the new tribes that come upon that are going to get ripped off. But he decides to stay out of it, let them interact as they do, and he'll just do his work.
And some of those tribes closer to the coast, again, you can see why he would avoid them, had some really horrendous to us, and I think to almost anybody, customs of interpreting dreams. And when it came to a dream about a child that you say you had killed that child, you would just kill the child. And girl babies in this one tribe in particular were just automatically killed or left to die. Boy babies also in great quantity sometime. And the idea was that, why do you kill the girl babies, he asked. It's, well, because they're not going to marry into our tribe, so they would marry into the tribe of one of our enemies and multiply our enemies against us. I mean, the logic was really strange. He said, well, why not just kind of marry into the tribe and say, that's disgusting. That, they consider that, I gather, incestuous. So some customs that he really had to wrap his head around, and some of them he really couldn't come to terms with.
Mm-hmm. Does he pass judgment?
He does express that he thinks that it's a very radical tactic and he doesn't understand it. But
he doesn't seem fazed by a lot of what he encounters.
Right. And it's probably because of all his time that he's been in the Americas, just living with different tribes, that he just is able to give us these observations, information on customs that are very different. And he knows that the reader is going to be shocked that it's something new, but that's what the reader wants at that time period.
Sure. They want something to know, sensational.
Right. They want to know about these natives. So he's smart. He knows what the reader wants to see. So they have to be sensational. And texts before him were as well. They would sometimes be accurate, other times be fictional. And that was normal.
He does say in his dedication to the king, though, that I am far from overstating things. I'm actually minimizing it because the thing itself is so remarkable, for better or worse, that it does not need any embellishment from me. And yet, he may well have been spinning some tales anyway.
It sells books. And as he's journeying home, and if there's just four survivors, does he have survivor's guilt that all these hundreds of men left behind? Or does he feel he was singled out somehow and that it's all right for him to be one of the four to survive this expedition?
He definitely feels fortunate, and it just goes back to that religious discourse of it's God's will. And it was very strong during that period, and that was the Catholic mindset. So not as much, because he just felt it was God's will. If a ship was going to sink, if they would get attacked, if there was an epidemic of some sort, he just felt that was God's will. And the survivors, himself and three other men, were meant to survive and bring back information to the king.
Although
and just be of use.
In some cases, he will say, well, the guy shouldn't have done that. I mean, there's an incident back in Florida where one of the cavalry men decides to ford. I can't remember if it was the Suwannee or something that was equally difficult at the time. Man and horse drown. And he said, well, you know, it didn't seem like a good idea to me, and it didn't work for him either. What kind of description does he give us when he finally encounters other Spaniards out there in the American Southwest?
Mm-hmm. Well, we see it. It's led up to it. He starts to see things from Christians, and he'll ask neighbors, where did you get that trinket? You know, he knows that that's coming from Europe. So he gets very excited, and he wants to find them and has the natives help him. Where did you see them? And they'll say, oh, these men that look just like you.
The guys with
are
the beards.
Over there. Yeah, guys with these beards are just like yours. We met them in this other town X miles away. So he's able to get reunited. The first set of Spaniards he meets, those were the bad Spaniards. They were the ones that he saw that were taking advantage of and the natives did not trust, very mistrustful. And he gained all this trust and authority through his work as a healer and then as a merchant. And so he has to convince them to work with them and to say it's okay, but you have to convert to Christianity and work with them or else they will kill you off. And he's giving a warning to the natives. And the second set of Spaniards he meet are nicer, and he's able to help them. And that's what goes back to what I was saying previously of the good, bad Christian. And so he definitely includes and depicts those bad Christians that they're going about this expedition the wrong way and are going about colonizing the wrong way, and how he's doing it the right way. And he's found the way to do it. And that's how he can be of more service to the king.
He certainly gets a wide variety of, I guess, human beings in by the time he's described the different tribes, the different kinds of Christians, the different men that he's traveling mm-hmm. with. We get a real gallery of human behavior. Can you tell us what happens to Cabeza de Vaca when he gets back? This narrative comes out in 1542. Does the end of his life live up to his expectations?
It usually doesn't, Lisa. And these expeditions, they usually don't. He wanted to lead another expedition out to the Americas, but it was given to someone else. And he refused to go because he wasn't going to be the commander. He really saw himself as that he needed to have that position that he had done so much service. So it doesn't go the way he wants it. He definitely wanted to be a governor and to lead, but we know that it doesn't go as planned.
I saw somewhere that it said he died in poverty.
Mm-hmm. And it happens a lot.
Yeah.
Christopher Columbus as well. We would think he was the first one, came over, gave us all this information, broke that myth that the world's flat. But he also died in poverty in a prison, and it doesn't go as planned.
Exploration doesn't pay, apparently.
Well,
not always.
Cabeza de Vaca, he did the South American expedition, mm-hmm. which the report of which is much longer than actually the one into North America, and sort of, I guess, ticked off his men one way or the other. And like Columbus, he was brought back in mm-hmm. chains, but he was eventually cleared and left free to die in poverty.
What a colorful life.
Yes.
It really is an amazing story mm-hmm. of adventure.
Well, as you say, Brenda, it's unusual in that it reads rather like a novel. And this, again, this is 100 years before Cervantes wrote Don Quixote. So
right,
in a sense, it almost is the first novel, mm-hmm. if you assume that there's even one or two exaggerations in there, or one or two, mm-hmm. what shall we say, fibs. Mm-hmm. Then you've got yourself a novel, don't you?
Yes.
And for mm-hmm. listeners who might tune in next week to start listening to the chapter a day version of the text, what would you say they're going to gain from it if they encounter this text that they wouldn't otherwise have?
Oh, I think they're going to gain just a perspective. Oh, it's so hard.
And really what I think it gives you is just a really fresh view of America as it was, a mm-hmm. part of America as it was almost 500 years mm-hmm. ago. I mean, all of it totally unfamiliar to us.
Right. And this is what I read in my classes. So for me, it's normal. This is the types of texts I'm reading constantly. So it's kind of hard for me to put myself in a reader that's not familiar with 16th century travel literature. But yes, I think as Norman said, they're just going to get this fresh look of America. And, you know, America, not as today, but as what it was, and unpopulated, and two diverse cultures clashing at times. Other times helping each other out.
Our guest has been Brenda Becerra Anderson. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.